Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we profile a young Illinois jazz player who's starting to make a name for himself. We talk to a librarian who has made a documentary about librarians. She's trying to dispel misconceptions people have about the profession. We look into the world of sock monkeys, and in honor of Halloween, we have our annual chat with a ghost hunter. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Disabled people in Africa often face significant discriminations, but this is changing in Ghana, partly thanks to the University of Illinois. As part of a long-term effort, the U of I is helping disabled athletes from Ghana prepare for next year's Paralympics in Beijing. Michael Kaliska has more.
Yes, sir.
About 15 wheelchair athletes whooshed down Windsor Road in Urbana. Among them are five athletes from the East African nation of Ghana. In the last few years, their life has changed tremendously.
Yeah, in the beginning, I didn't get a chair. I get my own chair in 2003 when we were in America. But in the previous, I was using crutches. Crutches, yeah. So training and movement, all my movements. Yeah, that's what I was doing.
Polio disabled Raphael Bucci and Kebe's legs when he was 6 years old. He had to wait 17 years to get a wheelchair. Only 1 year later, in 2004, Nkebe was one of two Ghanaian athletes who competed in the Paralympics in Athens.
Yeah, the sports has helped me a lot because now in Ghana, I can say I'm one of the disabled, the hero among the disabled athletes in Ghana because of I've been the first person to represent my nation in the Paralympics game in Athens, Greece. From 2003, every year I make sure I win one or two medals for the country.
It was the first time ever that Ghana took part in this event. Former wheelchair champion Gene Driscoll from Champaign was largely responsible for that. Driscoll won the Boston Marathon 8 times and won Olympic silver 2x. She's now a development official at the U of I. In 2001, Driscoll traveled to Ghana to help train wheelchair athletes.
We're sitting in a stadium and 32 people with disabilities showed up for this track camp. There were only about 6 who were in wheelchairs. Most of them walked in on crutches or using a walker, but there were others who crawled in. They had sandals on their hands and huge calluses on their knees. And during the track camp, for many of them, it was the first time they were up off the ground in a racing chair or in any kind of chair.
Driscoll says disabled people in Ghana have a tough time. She says many are stuck in their homes their entire lives. Driscoll decided that just coaching isn't enough to help the Ghanaian athletes, so she started raising money for wheelchairs.
In Ghana, if you have a disability, it's believed you're cursed by God, and many people are rejected by their families, rejected by society. You know, they're seen as the dogs running around on the ground, and they're the last ones to receive food. It's really disheartening.
Nkebe says his parents supported him, but being disabled created some problems.
Because of I'm the only male child for my mother, so it seems like in Africa the men also are the decision makers in the family. So, but they realize that they can't challenge God, so they must be behind me.
But getting respect from the community, Nkebe says, came through his success in sports. This year alone, he won 3 medals in sprint competitions at the All African Games.
It is being realized by the government of Ghana that if one disabled person can win a medal in maybe 800 meters and a whole football team of 22 or 23 can not win anything, and that means with a disabled there is a brighter future.
Cesar Gicuno is a national wheelchair racing coach. He says that sports have already had an impact on Ghanaian politics and society. He says a new bill has been passed which will provide free education to disabled children.
So much is changing so much. Now they now recognize us. The public now see us as a force, or as part of them.
And Nkebe says he believes that even more will change as he tries to qualify for the next year's Paralympics in Beijing.
That's the biggest dream of any good athlete in this world, because a Paralympic is the final point in any athlete's life. So that is our dream, to go there and take part, not to take part, but to be among the medal winners. That's what we are hoping for now.
I'm Michael Kuliska.
This is Sidetrack. Everything's coming up Sock Monkeys. That's the title of a new book from artist Bonnie Connolly. She chronicles the history of these homemade stuffed animals and their place in art and literature and everyday life. Her book is published by In My Own Dreams Publishing. I spoke with Connolly recently and asked her first to talk about the Rockford, Illinois company that made the socks that were used to make most sock monkeys.
It really started with John Nelson's invention of the seamless sock knitting machine. And that was in the 1870s. So I guess before the 1870s, there probably were no sock monkeys. Nelson Knitting Company incorporated in 1880, and their factory was located in Rockford, Illinois, and they were making, you know, socks for the workmen of America since then. And somewhere along the line, no one knows for sure, sock monkeys, the women, you know, started making sock monkeys, and it became more and more popular.
And eventually the company said, well, this is a great idea, and they started putting out instructions, right?
Yes. I think they started putting out instructions in the early 50s. I think that's some of the original sock monkey instructions started.
Now, you say that nobody knows where the first sock monkey came from.
No one will ever know because, you know, 99.9% of all the sock monkey makers are anonymous makers, so there's no way to know who they were. I met a woman a couple of weeks ago at a retirement center, and she said she had one when she was young. And since she was getting on in years, I asked her, you know, when she had it, and she said her mother made it for her in the mid early 30s. So I know, you know, they were making them back then, and there are a lot of stories like that. But since, you know, they weren't on record and there were nobody was putting their little trademark on it, nobody really knew who they were.
Well, it seems like with a lot of folk art, it just happens organically. And it makes me wonder, you know, what would make people look at a pair of socks and say, you know, this would make a good monkey?
You have to remember that women from way back in history, way back, were always making, you know, animals and dolls for their children from the, you know, household things, from bits of leftover fabric and yarn and things like that. They were already making cloth dolls. You know, the Raggedy Ann, for instance, was created by an artist in 1915, but they were already making cloth dolls at that point. So by the time they started manufacturing the socks and it became a part of the, you know, the family's household items, I think it was just a natural process to go, you know, I can stuff this and make it look like something. I've seen cats, you know, sock cats and all sorts of little creatures, you know.
Well, that's what your book features, not just monkeys, but elephants and all sorts of things. Tell me about some of the variations you've seen, not just in the type of monkey, but the other types of critters.
Yeah, but, you know, the monkey is...
The monkey's king.
Because it b- bears the closest resemblance to us, I think, as humans, is the one who really, that's the little animal that really caught on. But I truly think that by adding the red heel, and that happened in 1932, that really, if it didn't happen before that point, that really inspired, it would inspire me, because you look at it and the old heel looked like a smile, so you could, you know, very easily go, I could cut this and do this, and that, you know, I could make a little animal out of this, you know. So I think that's kind of how it took hold.
Now, your book is not just the history of this folk art, the sock monkeys, but it also talks about sock monkeys in other aspects, in modern arts. It talks about people who collect sock monkeys. It talks about sock monkeys in literature. Tell me how you thought about all these different elements being connected.
Well, it didn't start that way. I am a artist, and you know, I started also with a sock monkey when I was really young, and I didn't have it all my life because I got carsick on it when I was young. But later became an artist and always loved to do, you know, old toys and things like that in my art. And so when my sister's daughter was born, my aunt, who was a big sock monkey maker, gave her one, and I saw it sitting in a cradle with a bunch of Indian masks and things in it, and inspired a drawing. And then later when I had my own daughter and she got her sock monkey, I switched from doing surrealistic things into children's illustration, and that's where the sock monkey started coming in for me. But I was an artist, and everything that, and I didn't have a collection, I had one sock monkey. Everything about sock monkeys for me was art. And being in business, I bought products, I was making all sorts of products, I was writing children's stories and illustrating them, and it wasn't until I did this, came on to the idea of doing this book in 2005, that, you know, I really wanted to find everything that was out there. I wanted to see what other people were doing, to see if people were doing, you know, art, you know, were doing art and what quality of art they were doing. And I had always wanted to do a sock monkey store art gallery. So I decided to, you know, just start research to find out, you know, everything and everyone I could find. And in the process of doing that, I uncovered, you know, all sorts of goodies. And that's, I mean, I did know about some of the books, some of the children's books that were there, but I found far many more than, you know, anybody knew about. So it was just a discovery process, you know.
Well, what is it about this icon of folk art, the sock monkey, that attracts you to it?
Well, it's, you know, as an artist, well, I don't know. I can't tell you why I've always been attracted to toys, old toys and dolls and things. But I think, you know, in the end, I think that the sock monkey is linked to our inner child. And for me, in the process of doing all these illustrations, I sort of came to find that part of me was trying to reintroduce me to my inner child. And I think for most people, that's the way it is. It's that you that you really are that's trying to connect with you, and that's kind of what happens with the sock monkey for everybody, I think.
Is that the feeling you got from the collectors?
Collectors are, well, there was one collector who, because her parents never allowed her to have any toys in the house or anything, she became a collector of toys. And so she had hundreds and hundreds of sock monkeys as an adult and all sorts of other toys because she didn't want to be denied the right to have toys. But collectors in general are people who are the type of person who will go to, you know, auctions and antique shops and junk and thrift stores and things. And I don't know, there's a lot of collectors who just love dolls and love old toys and things that they think will be, you know, valuable in years to come. I think people, though, when they're the collector type, they see the sock monkeys and they see that all of them are very, very different, and that's just a really fun thing when you start seeing all the varieties and you go, oh my goodness, this is really cool. And I think that's kind of what happened with the collectors.
Now, the sock monkeys nowadays, the socks that they are made out of, they've changed. Is that right?
Yes, they have.
So you can't get a pure sock monkey anymore.
Well, pure, I don't know what that...
Maybe that's the wrong word, but authentic, you know, maybe...
They changed and not for the better, I can say. Originally, they were made to be worn as a workman's sock, so they had to be durable. You know, like the jeans were originally workman's clothing, and it had to be really sturdy and durable. And in 1992, when Fox River Mills took over, and it was pretty much a craft item at this point. That's where they changed the red heel. It didn't have the smile anymore. It sort of has a funny little look to it. And the quality went down because they were just making it for a craft item and not for a sock that, you know, that a person would wear. If you put them on and you try to wear them, they annoy your feet. So they changed. They just changed for that reason, I guess. But, you know, people are making sock monkeys out of every kind of sock possible. It's the brown and red and white heel there is the traditional one, but there's a new wave of sock monkey makers that are making them out of every known sock, you know, so they're coming up striped and bold colors and everything creative. It's really pretty wild.
So there's Argyle sock monkeys out there.
Absolutely. Everything paisley. There's everything. Any sock that's made can make a sock monkey, and a lot of. In fact, there was a group of artist collectors that were featured in the book that really got into making really wild ones. They made ones with unicorn things and with one-eyed and every possible. I don't know. They just made creatures. They just started making creatures. It was funny. But that's really caught on. The new colors and have really caught on.
So what is in store now for you and sock monkeys?
What's in store for me? Well, actually, I'm trying to finish the second book. That's called Calling All Sock Monkeys. there was so much that I found in the first one that I knew I couldn't cover in 160 pages, so I knew right away I was going to be working on the second one to kind of cover it all. And then I knew there were going to be all sorts of artists and collectors that I didn't find first time around that I was going to discover. And book number two is in the works, but I'm also working on a couple of little board books for children. And in the process of having to do the book signing tours and stuff, I've had to start making sock monkeys. And so, in fact, I've gotten to about 100 now. I never pictured that I'd be making sock monkeys, but it's pretty fun.
Well, everything is coming up sock monkeys, isn't it?
It certainly is. but the most important thing is that somewhere along the line, I do want to go back to drawing again. I think I loved, more than anything, I love drawing them. It's a way that my inner child does get to speak, and it hasn't been able to speak for a while. So that's what I really look forward to, is going back to my studio and drawing.
That was Bonnie Connolly, author of Everything's Coming Up Sock Monkeys, The Art History and Business of the American Sock Monkey. It's published by In My Own Dreams Publishing. you've got it tuned to Sidetrack. This year's Monterey Jazz Festival featured many top jazz artists, including Diane Krall and Ornette Coleman. Also taking the stage was the Next Generation Jazz Orchestra, a specially selected top-notch group of high school jazz performers. Plopped down in the first tenor sax seat was Bloomington's own Adam Larson. As arts reporter Laura Kennedy tells us, Larson likely has a bright future and some tough choices ahead of him.
It's Saturday evening at Swinger's Grill in Normal, and the Adam Larson Quartet is swinging hard. Today it's in Normal, but this weekend, the 17-year-old Larson is playing on the same stage as many of the artists who have just the sort of full-time music career he desires. The opportunity to play in a showcase for hot young talents has Larson eager for the future.
I'd like to have my own established group and also be a sideman in a really established group. I would love to just be able to just have my group and that be the super group and the new hot thing, you know, but I also want to be realistic too. You know, if that happens, then great, you know, that's my dream right there. But I also have realistic options too.
Larson says those include backing up pop singers like John Mayer in a brass section. He credits his success thus far to work ethic. Music is so encompassing, he can't imagine a life without it.
It's something that I wake up each day and, you know, my first inclination is either to turn on music or play music, or I still have something in my head from last night, you know.
If Adam's determination wavers, his father, John Larson, is there to back him up. As a music educator, John worked with many young musicians and knows when someone has the right stuff. If he didn't believe Adam had a good chance, John says he wouldn't encourage him.
Now is the time to do it, because you can always be something else, and I'm a living example of that, having gone from being a music educator to being a computer analyst. It changed at age 40. And so there's always time to do other stuff. But if you interrupt your playing and your practicing habit, it's pretty hard to get back from that.
That's veteran tenor sax man Harry Allen. For 20 years, Allen has lived Adam Larson's dream of gigging all over the world, acting as a sideman, and heading his own groups. Allen says studying music at some college is a career help, but to become a full-time player, Larson should carefully think about the location.
I didn't go to college really to learn about music. I went to college so I could be around New York City, so I could go in and hear the people that were my heroes, because I knew that that was the way I was going to learn the most.
And Allen says he made an easy transition to full-time work after graduation. Adam Larson seems to have the same idea. He plans to attend the Manhattan School of Music to make enough connections to establish himself when he gets out.
As much as I like to maybe minor in business or production or something that maybe people think is more stable, I want to give myself that chance, because it only comes by once, and the longer you wait in life to, you know, I want to be a player, the harder it gets.
I think Adam is pretty exceptional. I think he has the potential to be a player and make a living playing.
Tom Marco is a professor in the ISU School of Music. He balances teaching with weekend gigging as a jazz drummer.
More and more, jazz is living in the institutions, the educational institutions. And there's plenty of players like Adam out there who would kill for a full-time teaching job or possibly some kind of other day job to make money so they can just do what they want on the side.
Marco says what first seems like a compromise may eventually offer Adam the best of both worlds, especially when the pitter-patter of little feet begins to drown out the sound of bebop.
There's plenty of times that I wish I could just practice and play, but reality is the truth, and you know, you have to do what it takes to, you know, to make a steady living, especially if you want to have a family and raise kids and buy a home and have a sense of settledness to your life.
In fact, Adam has been teaching younger players since his sophomore year of high school. But he is not willing to confuse a settled life with settling for less. And his father, John Larson, says that so long as his son takes a business-like approach to music, he stands a chance of making it. As his own booking agent, Adam holds down more than 100 gigs a year. John Larson says it's all about creating opportunities. even where none are obvious.
Places that are not known to be jazz clubs have become jazz clubs because of his impetus and others. It all boils down to, at some point in time, you have to pay the bills or you have to make it an A vocation.
John Larson says he thinks Adam understands that making music as art and not as a living will limit his choices. Adam Larson says he's trying to develop songwriting chops. Larson will keep gigging around to preserve those choices and prepare his dream. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You're listening to Sidetrack. Ann Seidel is on a quest to change how people look at librarians. She's the manager of a Denver-based library consulting business, and she says many of us take the profession for granted. She has recently written and directed a new documentary on the various roles librarians play. The Hollywood Librarian is making its trek across the country, screening in nearly 90 cities this week. Jeff Bossert recently spoke with Seidel.
The more that idea took hold in my head, the more I noticed it in my environment, that people just haven't connected the dots with all of those resources in the library with a human thinking, intelligent being who's thought to put it there and figured out a way for everyone to find it. And so as I progressed in my degree and as I progressed in my love of the profession and my skill within the profession, I decided that it was really time for a documentary film about librarians that shows really what it is we do truthfully and positively. So I'm not a filmmaker. I'm a librarian, and I'm proud to call myself a librarian. And one of these days, I keep telling myself, I will be able to be a librarian again.
You mentioned having a little bit of radio and TV experience, but a first-time filmmaker has to get a crew together and have a little bit of expertise involved.
Yes, and the good thing about being a librarian when one sets out to do a film is that you know, if not what you know, but you know where to find things. So the very first thing I did when I decided that this film was my mission, I had to pursue it until the very end. I could never give up until this film existed in the world. Was I more or less went to Ann Seidel's School of Film and, you know, independent documentary. So I read everything I could get my hands on. I watched everything I could get my hands on. I started to study film technique, documentary and narrative construction, visual vocabulary that film demands. And I started to learn the language of film essentially on my own. Certainly, I didn't teach it to myself. I learned from great, great people in books and film. Was I going to shoot on film? There's the whole new digital menu of options in documentary filmmaking now. What, you know, balance did I have to strike between cost and look of the film, how to process film if I was going to go the film route. And so we settled on the Panasonic Varicam, which is a high-definition digital film. And that was a really, really good choice. And luckily, I got my hands on a camera that I could rent. This is a $150,000 camera, so I had to carted around with about $1 million worth of insurance on it in case anything happened to it. That was, of course, the end of the film, if anything happened to the camera. So we all sort of considered the film, the camera our baby. So it was very much learning by doing and trial by fire. But I had really, really generous and supportive people around me.
So you decided you wanted to make a film to show the public what librarians really do. What was your, you know, how did you go about achieving that?
Well, the first step was believing that I could do it in the face of all evidence to the contrary, never having done it before. And literally, I, over and over again, Jeff, during the course of the development of the project, I deliberately avoided knowing too much at any given point. I learned precisely what I needed to know for the next day, week, or month. And I never looked any further than that because I knew it would swamp me. It would overwhelm me. The first steps were conceiving of the film. What did I want to say? What kinds of messages did I feel important to bring to a general audience? What did I think the audience would enjoy seeing about the world of librarians, which is basically everywhere? There are more public libraries in this country than McDonald's, and libraries receive over 1 billion visits a year. So it's one of those things that it's hiding in plain sight. Libraries are everywhere. They're very much a part of the American existence and landscape, psychologically and physically. And the question is, how do I sort of peel back that curtain and show the magic that happens to make those libraries available to all of us? I was shaking my boots most of the time. Luckily, I have a good poker face and a big fat smile that I try to use as often as I can. And that, you know, I read someplace that confidence isn't the cause of action. It's actually the result of action. So that's what happened to me. I didn't have that much confidence going into it. I had a real desire. But the confidence that I have now in the film and in the film process came as a result of the actions I took rather than as a cause for taking action.
So was it a sampling of, did you interview librarians over a large area, or what ended up being this game plan, so to speak?
The first thing I did was I started to review Hollywood films that had librarians in them. So I searched and hunted and rented movies and bought movies, and that in those days on VHS tape, because that was the predominant format. And I looked at filmographies and really studied film that showed librarians. I analyzed their role, and over again, of course, the stereotypical librarian emerged. She or he was a laughable figure or a pitiable figure or played the role of obstructing the protagonist and therefore lended to the plot points of going through the journey for the protagonist in the film. So I watched literally hundreds and hundreds of films with librarian roles in them, no matter how small a reference or how oblique the librarian appeared. You know, she could just be in the background, or it could be a library setting without a librarian in it. But I watched them all, and I made notes about them. I made a database of them, what year they came out, were they black and white or in color, who directed them, the kind of role there was it a nominal role or a supporting role or a starring role. And then as those films came together in my head, I started to make connections and do that kind of analysis. Well, we have a predominance of this kind of librarian. The laughable librarian, the lighthearted librarian. There are scenes in libraries about flirting. There's scenes in libraries with danger in them. There are whole sets and subsets of librarian roles. So as that information kept mulling over in my head, starting in about 1998, I realized that those were the departure points for interviews and questions with actual librarians. As I started to make a list, a wish list, if you will, of the people that I knew or knew of in the librarian profession. The very first thing I did was make a map of the United States and where these people lived. And that wish list changed and grew, and things were discarded due to distance or cost or timing was wrong. And in the last analysis, we shot for 11 months, and we went really from coast to coast, from Florida to California. And I compiled about 42 interviews with librarians, principals, patrons, community leaders, and authors. And I guess those are the stats of the film. We had 56 hours of raw footage that I went through and came up with a 90-minute film, which is actually not as bad as it sounds. There's a lot of work in that, but a lot of documentaries compile 200 or 300 hours of raw footage.
Well, and maybe the reason you had so much less footage than some documentary filmmakers is that you knew your subject so well.
That's absolutely true, I think, Jeff. That's very insightful. I knew what I wanted to be asked and answered. I didn't know necessarily how it would be answered, but I knew what the answers that I wanted answers to these questions. So being part of the profession was very useful in my case. I don't know if it's useful in all cases, but for me, it was nice to know this small world. It's not small in terms of size. It's a healthy profession in terms of its numbers, but it's exclusive and unique to itself, just like the medical profession or the law profession. And it was good to know, and it was good to have a very solid grounding in librarianship and having worked in the profession. And also, I played sort of a dual role. I wanted to tell the story as a librarian, and I also wanted to hear the story as a patron of libraries, lifelong patron of libraries. So I think a director, probably in every film, has to think both of his subject and his audience at the same time. And that was a fun role to play. That was fun to develop in my own heart.
So what's the greatest misconception of librarians, either through movies you watched or what you learned from your interviews?
I would say that the greatest misperception of the librarian profession is that libraries sort of just happen. I think people believe that libraries are kind of a natural resource in American life, kind of like the Grand Canyon, and they've always been there and they're always going to be there. And I think it's surprising to people that librarians do everything that make a library happen. I think it's possible for some people to think of a library and a librarian in different categories, that the library is there and the librarian is just sort of the kind of person who's attracted to books or details or even rules in the worst-case scenario and just likes to work in a library, as opposed to a librarian actually creates that library. I'm not sure if doctors actually create hospitals, but a library without a librarian is like a radio without batteries. Without a librarian, libraries don't exist. Without somebody dedicated and determined to preserving all the records of human expression in books, in print, in computers, in art, in music, and then creating an environment for you to access all those expressions of other human beings. Everything from the lighting and the signage to the chairs and the carpet on the floor are decisions that are made by librarians daily. So I think the biggest misconception is that people just have a very little, you know, small understanding of how much work it takes to run a library and create and maintain a library, and that the librarian is the boss of that library.
You've made the decision to screen it in libraries.
That's right. With an independent film, at the end of the production, when the film is done, every single independent filmmaker, I'm sure, comes up with the same question. Okay, how do I get people to see it? And for the most part, you try to take it to festivals and try to get a distributor. That is somebody who will buy the rights to the film and then work within the theater network in this country and the U.S. and Canada. Often the North American rights go together. And you sell the film to a distributor, whether it's Fox or MGM or United Artists or Columbia or TriStar or any number of these distributors. And their job then and their right then is to get it into as many theaters as they think is useful to them. Well, there's a lot of questions in that process, and there's not a lot of empowerment for the filmmaker, certainly the first-time independent filmmaker, as I was. And while I don't really care whether the film makes any money at all in distribution, I was very invested in having people see it because I made this for the general audiences. And there's, as I say, so many thousands of libraries in this country, and something along the lines of 65 or 70,000 professional librarians working today in the country. It just seemed obvious to me that I needed to tap into that network for pragmatic reasons. It was more likely to be shown and widely shown if I could get librarians to agree to show it. And philosophically, it made sense. The message of the film is the integral importance of librarians to libraries and to American life and democracy, as well as, you know, larger issues of humanity and connection. And so in order to support the message of the film, it made real sense to have people, rather than buy a ticket at a movie theater next to the next animated movie or the next thriller or slasher or even the next documentary, but to actually buy a ticket and go see it at a library. That will connect people, the dots in people's minds about the role of librarians in the library resources that they often take for granted.
That was Jeff Bossert speaking with Ann Seidel, the writer, director, and inspiration behind the film The Hollywood Librarian. For more background on the film, clips, and where it's screening, visit HollywoodLibrarian.com. This is Sidetrack. Every October, we like to get into the Halloween spirit by calling up a real-life ghost hunter. One such hunter is Dale Kaczmarek, head of the Ghost Research Society based near Chicago. We last talked with him in 2003. When I called him up recently, I asked him what he's been up to.
Well, there's been a lot of interesting cases we've been on, including a trip to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. I was out there actually as part of a conference that was in Fredericksburg, Maryland, actually, and on the way back from the conference, I gave a talk on spirit of photography. We stopped at Gettysburg, which is, as you probably know, one of the biggest battles of the Civil War, July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of 1863. There was more than 63,000 casualties in that battle. And there are several sections of the battlefield that are extremely haunted. One in particular, right around the charge up the Little Round Top near the Devil's Den and Triangular Field, which is all part of a push by the Confederates to get up the hill. Now, one section of the battlefield, Triangular Field, other ghost researchers had tried some experimentation down there and apparently had gotten on videotape what looks like a Confederate soldier actually trying to climb over the wall on high-speed night vision Sony cameras. So we wanted to try to replicate that and see if we could find the exact area where that was done, and we found that with their help, we were out there in the battlefield about 8:30, 9 o'clock in the evening, and it was pretty dark out there. We set up these Sony night shot cameras that can literally see in total darkness. And we had set several up, and we kind of waited and waited and waited, and really nothing happened except the constant flow of people coming out there in the middle of the night, snapping pictures and so forth. About 9:45 or so, getting ready to pack up the battlefield, close at 10 o'clock, when myself and my research assistant, Jim Graycheck, had noticed the distinct smell and odor of cherry pipe tobacco kind of drift down the hill. We found it kind of unusual because there was nobody nearby. The cars had all left, and we were just kind of in a hollow, so the smoke or the odor had to actually drift down the hill to get to us. Well, soon after that, we both distinctly heard hoofbeats, the clip-clop of a horse in a slow walk, walking along the asphalt driveways through Gettysburg. And again, in the middle of the night, something that even a forest ranger that would have had horses would not have taken a horse out, especially at night. We looked around. We didn't see anything, but we abruptly heard these sounds completely stop. And about a few seconds later, about 30 seconds or so later, we both distinctly saw a figure walking up the side of the hill towards the Devil's Den. He was too far away to see if he was dressed in a uniform, but he definitely was going up a very steep hill in the middle of the night with no flashlight, not stumbling, not faltering at all, just like he was kind of almost marching up the hill. And he was very nicely silhouetted against the backdrop of the lights coming from the town of Gettysburg. So he was a very distinct figure. And as we left the area and headed in that direction, there was absolutely no car that figure would have came from. So it was interesting that we both smelled, heard, and saw something at Gettysburg that evening. So that was one of the highlights of recent years.
Well, you mentioned spirit photography, which I believe we talked about last time. Is that still very popular?
Oh, yes. I still get an average of 2 to 3 photographs a day through my website, ghostresearch.org, and people are invited to send along their what they believe to be pictures that they have taken in the past that show evidence for spirits or something that's unusual that they can't explain. And we do a free analysis. All we do ask is that people do visit the Spirit Photography page or click on the tab on the main page that says analysis that tells you how to properly send in your photographs and what information we do need. And we look at these photographs, and again, the large portion of these photographs do very often have natural explanations. But on occasion, I still do get some that are a little hard to explain or impossible to explain, and they get kind of put into this paranormal category, which we simply cannot explain. Now, some actually do look like faces, figures, or strange forms that were not caused by reflections, lens glare, bad film, double exposure, or any other of the causes that we look for based on the type of camera and the conditions that the people tell us when they were taking the photographs. So, yeah, we still do get a lot of these photographs from people, mostly through the email. It's much quicker. It's the information superhighway, as they say, at the Internet. But occasionally I get some also through, just regular mail as well. So it's something that keeps me quite busy to this day.
Well, I was looking on your website, and one of these photos really struck me. It's a picture of two women, tourist picture. They're standing, and there's this ghostly arm on the side of the photo that is actually, has reached out and has grabbed one of the women.
Correct.
Tell me about that one.
Well, that was, we call it the friendly ghost, I believe, is what that image is called on the site, because it looks like it's almost putting a friendly arm around one of the women. These two women were out in the evening, just out and about, and as you know, a lot of people have cameras on their cell phones nowadays, and that was taken when their cell phone camera, I guess they had a friend or maybe just somebody walking by, snap a picture of them as they were out and about that evening. And, of course, the person taking the photograph saw absolutely nothing, and they didn't actually look at the photograph until later when they got home, when they reviewed the photographs that evening, and that photograph in particular. When they saw that, sent it to me, and gave me permission to put it up on the site. And I've gotten a lot of feedback from that picture in the past, from people looking at it. What I try to do is, if people wish to, I like to put their email on there with the pictures so they can get their own positive or negative feedback on the picture. And sometimes it helps for them to kind of reassure them that what they have taken is what it actually is.
How has the fact that digital cameras have taken over, as opposed to old film cameras, how has that changed the nature of spirit photography?
Well, of course, with digital cameras, you get that instant picture. And so you know instantly if there's something there. As with 35-millimeter cameras or 110 or 126 Brownie cameras that use conventional film, you have to have that processed. And usually it takes a few days to get that film back. You're no longer at the location when you get the film back, so you can't try any further experiments. But with the advent of digital photography, you can snap that picture of an area. And if an image does show up on that particular digital print or digital file, then it's instant. You see it automatically. You can try out other experiments. You can try other snapshots immediately to see if it was simply maybe a weird reflection, some natural explanation, or it's really something there. Now, before digital photography came out, the only thing that we had that was kind of instant was the old Polaroid cameras that would snap a picture. It would exit the camera and develop in your hand in about 60 seconds. Now, those we still use, but the film is rather expensive. Now, digital, there's no film. Basically, you can take, with these little memory cards you can put in, you can take 500 or 600 to 700 pictures on the memory cards, and if you don't like it, you erase it, try it all over again. So digital does help out quite a bit in ghost hunting because it gives you that instant gratification if something is there.
Well, also with this new digital age, there's a lot of photo editing software out there. So I'm sure there's a lot more photos that come your way that are either obviously faked or borderline, but probably faked.
Yeah, and not only with Photoshop and other digital editing programs that you can literally pop an image in there and make it look pretty convincing sometimes. But it takes a kind of a keen eye to determine and to really analyze that to see if there's usually telltale signs that the image has been pasted in there. And we do look for those telltale signs as we're taking the image from the email we get, putting it into our commercial software programs that we use, and to try to determine what it is. Now, usually, I like to say, if it looks too good to be true, sometimes that there's a chance that that may be we call it just Photoshopped or pasted in there in some way. But I've seen very convincing images that were either digital and or 35 millimeter, because even a 35 millimeter print can be scanned in using a scanner and then also altered or in some way faked. You have to watch for that as well. But I've only seen really in the past, since we talked last in 2003, maybe only a handful that maybe six or seven that were kind of borderline that may have been faked, that just looked a little bit too convincing, because it's not that the way the thing was pasted in there, but actually that the figure looks too perfect, almost like it was a prefabricated image that somebody fabricated on a commercial paint program and then pasted in there because it just looks too perfect. Usually ghostly images, they almost look cartoonish, in fact, the ones that have been pasted in there. So they're real easy, usually, pretty much to spot when people try to fake them. But for the most part, we get an average amount of people that send in images that are just explainable through other means, double exposure. What I get a lot is people photographing mirrors, windows, houses, and things show up in the windows, reflections in the window. I get a lot of that. The thing we have to watch out for in those images is that when you're taking pictures of very highly reflective surfaces, it can be windows, mirrors, glass, television screens, even highly polished paneling. When the image does show up on the finished product, the thing you have to question is that sometimes these images are not always in the line of sight when you're snapping them. They may have been something that had been reflected on these reflective surfaces, not directly back 90 degrees, or 180 degrees back towards the person, but off to one side or another. And usually an exploration of the surrounding area usually kind of yields that subject matter that was reflected in the window. And very often when you do things like outdoors and houses, it's most often the trees, the foliage, kind of playing tricks on your eye by creating the illusion that it's actually a face when it really isn't.
Now, besides examining spirit photography and going out to various locations, you also do a Haunted Chicago tour, and you've been doing this now for 25 years. Has what people want to see changed in that 25 years?
Oh, yes. When I first started back in 1982, I had approximately 50 or so locations that I knew of in the south, in the suburban area in Chicagoland. That has increased basically to about 185 public spots. Now, there's probably thousands of non-public spots, but we don't specifically visit those. These are locations that people can actually visit on their own. It can be cemeteries, churches, restaurants, bowling alleys, murder sites, sacred sites throughout Chicago and the suburbs. When I first began doing this in 1982, I thought it'd be a good idea to actually run a tour where people could actually experience the aura of a haunted location and perhaps even partake in the haunting themselves if the ghost was active that particular evening or afternoon when we went past there, and always encourage people to bring along cameras and tape recorders and camcorders and so forth. And throughout the years, many people have experienced things on the tours in the past, and many have photographed things that they don't often see, but later when they're reviewing their camera or their film, their audio tape or whatever, something does show up. And we've gotten a lot of snippets from that have come on the weeks following our tours, as we usually end our tours in mid-November for the Halloween season, but we do run the tours pretty much year-round now, every Saturday and Sunday. We do get a number of people that do send us these images that we have to then go through to try to explain, you know, what's in the picture. But the Ghost Tours Excursions into the Unknown Incorporated is a product of the Ghost Research Society, which also, by the way, is celebrating its 30th year as a society this year. It was founded back in 1977, so we got kind of a double anniversary in 2007.
And you also have a press, the Ghost Research Society Press, that puts out books. Tell me what sort of titles you have.
Yeah, we have 11 titles. That Ghost Research Society Press was founded jointly between myself and Jim Drachik, who's my research assistant. We started out initially with our books, my books that I had published called Windy City Ghosts, Windy City Ghosts 2, A Field Guide to Spirit Photography, and Illuminating the Darkness to Mystery Spook Lights. And Jim had a couple of books that he had already had written. We write, besides writing full-blown books, we also write smaller field guides. And he put together a field guide series, which are smaller books that can almost fit in the back of your pocket, you kind of tag along with you to locations that you're investigating. It gives you the site, the address, how to get there, and description of the history and the hauntings. So it's very useful in the field, and that's why they're called field guides. So he had put out initially a field guide to Chicago hauntings and a field guide to the land of Lincoln, which covers the entire state of Illinois. He's also put out a few others just recently, including a field guide to mysterious waters, which includes lighthouses, beaches, shipwrecks, ghost ships. And the most recent book that he's produced is called The Field Guide to America's Most Haunted, which kind of go all across the country. To different locations haunted in nature.
And that website, again, for not just the books, but if people have the spirit photography or if they have a haunting they want you guys to investigate?
Yeah, the Ghost Research Society website is www.ghostresearch.org.
That was Dale Kaczmarek, head of the Ghost Research Society, which is based near Chicago. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580 WILL Urbana.